Welcome to today's critique. We are diving into a deeply researched scholarly white paper titled The Sovereignty of Credit, which analyzes how financial systems act as hidden constitutional powers over human and ecological futures and proposes a life-coherent alternative.
Right, and jumping straight into our first area of focus regarding structure and flow, the transition from the universal architectural analysis to the specific Caribbean diagnostic lens requires stronger structural scaffolding to fully maximize its impact.
Because, I mean, assessing the core strength of this piece, the author has done an exceptional job building a massive global and historical framework across the first six sections.
They really have. They introduce these incredibly robust concepts, things like the financial power stack and the great financial inversion.
Right, and the hierarchy of the protectable.
Exactly. It's brilliant. However, the weakness here is that when the text shifts into Section 7, which focuses entirely on the Caribbean and small island condition, well, it feels like a sudden drop into a highly specific geographic case study.
Yeah, I mean, the text explicitly notes the Caribbean is meant to be a diagnostic lens, but the reader experiences a bit of structural whiplash.
Complete whiplash. You're moving abruptly from these sweeping concepts of global derivatives and central banking straight into Eastern Caribbean correspondent banking vulnerabilities.
It's just a really harsh pivot, you know?
Right. So the suggestion for improvement is to foreshadow the Caribbean condition not just as a late-stage diagnostic lens, but as the ultimate stress test interwoven throughout the earlier historical and theoretical sections.
So by planting those seeds early on, the arrival at Section 7 will feel like the inevitable, powerful culmination of the entire paper's thesis.
Exactly, rather than just a localized detour.
Let's look closely at the section discussing the historical construction of credit sovereignty. That's Section 3, right?
Right, Section 3.
So in Section 3, when discussing how plantation finance and colonial extraction built the early templates of financial calculation, they could explicitly connect this to the modern Caribbean's inherited constraints.
That is a perfect concrete example. You don't need a whole page for it. Just explicitly link how those historical colonial templates constrain modern debt issuance right there in the text.
And then maybe they could do the same in Section 5, the one on how finance governs the present.
Yes, absolutely. When detailing the refinancing trap in that section, they should briefly cite small island states as the most acute contemporary example of this trap.
Wait, let me push back on this a little bit. Is there a risk that focusing solely on foreshadowing the Caribbean early on might accidentally narrow the paper, making it feel less universally applicable?
I mean, that's clearly laid out. I wonder, though, if we've considered that the specific actually illuminates the universal.
Oh, interesting. How so?
Well, grounding the abstract global theory in the concrete reality of small states early on actually makes the whole global theory easier to digest. The U.S. or the Eurozone mask the underlying mechanics of the credit system because they issue the reserve currency.
Right. They control their domestic money.
Exactly. Small island states make the boundary brutally visible. So seeding that early gives the reader a tangible anchor.
Okay, I see that. So moving to our second piece of feedback under completeness and focus, the actionable pathway for de-implementation requires expansion to match the weight and rigorous detail of the preceding theoretical diagnosis.
This is probably the biggest opportunity to elevate the practical impact of the paper.
Because the weakness is there's a glaring imbalance between the diagnosis and the cure, right?
Exactly. The paper does a masterful job deconstructing how financial claims consume the life ground, and it lays out this beautiful framework for a life-coherent credit constitution.
It really is a powerful framework.
It is. However, building on our previous point about structural flow, when the text finally reaches the mechanism of transition in Section 8, specifically the concept of de-implementation, it is introduced very late and passed over way too briefly.
The reader is entirely convinced by the diagnosis, but is left wondering exactly how a society safely unwinds destructive financial defaults.
Right, because you have to do it without crashing the functional continuity of the systems people rely on daily.
Yeah, it's as if a master architect has handed us a flawless blueprint for a new, life-sustaining city, but only gave us a sticky note explaining how to safely demolish the old, crumbling city we currently live in.
Oh, wow, that is the perfect analogy. You can't just blow up the old city without a plan.
No, you'd bring the roof down on everyone.
Exactly. So the suggestion here is to expand the de-implementation and transition subsection by providing a structured framework or phased approach for unwinding these systems.
And they should apply the exact same analytical rigor that was applied earlier to the financial power stack, right?
Yes, that's exactly it. For a concrete example, they could create a de-implementation matrix that directly mirrors the six layers of the financial power stack.
Oh, I like that. So showing what de-implementation looks like at the infrastructural layer versus the disciplinary layer.
Right. At the infrastructural layer, that could be unwinding proprietary payment platforms.
And then at the disciplinary layer, maybe rewriting sovereign debt covenants to include disaster clauses.
Exactly. By matching the cure to the six layers of the disease, the pathway becomes an actionable roadmap.
But they also need to prove this is practically possible, don't they?
Yes, which leads to another concrete example the author should provide. One detailed historical example of successful de-implementation.
Like, perhaps how certain post-war Bretton Woods capital controls were implemented or unwound?
That would be brilliant, showing how governments deliberately implemented capital controls to ring-fence domestic economies proves to the reader that deliberately withdrawing financial rules without causing total systemic collapse is practically possible.
It just grounds the whole transition plan in reality.
Exactly. It gives the cure the same institutional gravity as the diagnosis.
Which brings us to our final piece of feedback, focusing on tone and style. The powerful concepts of the ecological creditor and the civil common should be elevated earlier in the text to concretely anchor the philosophical arguments about the life ground.
The weakness we identified here is really about cognitive load. In section 6, the paper introduces the life ground beneath the balance sheet.
Right, a crucial concept.
But this section relies heavily on complex, highly theoretical terminology. Things like financial autopoietization and organized not knowing.
I mean, which is intellectually robust, absolutely, but it risks becoming overly abstract for the reader.
Very abstract. Meanwhile, the incredibly resonant, tangible ideas of the ecological creditor, you know, states that preserve biodiversity but are treated as financial debtors, and digital money as a civil commons, are just buried in Section 7 and 8.
So the suggestion is to pull these highly evocative, concrete metaphors forward.
Yes, use them as the defining pillars of the life ground from the very moment the concept is introduced. This will give the reader immediate, real-world handles to grasp the philosophical concepts.
So for a concrete example, they could introduce the term ecological creditor right in the abstract or introduction.
Building on that point, what if we looked at it from the perspective of how these phrases instantly shift the reader's paradigm?
Oh, that's a great point.
Yeah. Terms like ecological creditor are not just academic jargon, they are narrative weapons that perfectly encapsulate the great financial inversion.
Right. It serves as the ultimate stark juxtaposition to the traditional financial sovereign.
Exactly. You want the reader visualizing that injustice immediately. And then, as another concrete example, when defining the life ground in Section 6, use the civil commons of digital public money as the primary contemporary example of what a life-coherent system actually looks like in practice.
Rather than holding it back until the end of Section 8.
Right. Don't leave it abstract. Give them the immediate illustration of robust public payment systems that can't be shut off during a crisis.
Anchoring it with the civil commons and the ecological creditor prevents the reader from drifting into pure abstraction.
Exactly. It gives those brilliant philosophical insights real teeth.
So, to recap today's critique, the author has submitted an incredibly strong, deeply insightful piece of work.
Absolutely. It makes a strong, rigorous case for a life-coherent financial system.
But to elevate it further, we recommend three actionable steps. First, provide stronger structural scaffolding by foreshadowing the Caribbean diagnostic lens earlier in the historical sections.
Second, expand the section on de-implementation into a phased, concrete matrix so the transition pathway matches the brilliance of the diagnosis.
And finally, elevate evocative concepts like the ecological creditor and the civil commons to the front of the text to anchor the abstract philosophy of the life ground.
We highly encourage the author to implement these structural and thematic adjustments.
We absolutely do, and we warmly invite them to submit their revised work back to us for another critique in the future.